Well, good evening and welcome to round three. Before we start, I want to celebrate what we think is the world's first interfaith voyage up to Copper Basin yesterday. Huh? There we go. Yeah, I will. Yeah, never mind the hair on all of us. We were working hard. So I want to. It was a fun day.
It was the first interfaith selfie. It looks like.
Oh yeah, the first interfaith selfie up at Copper Basin apparently is what it is.
Got me in there, and then I don't have to hide.
Sure. Yeah. We can do anything for a fee. kidding. So our panel. Our guests and our friends, Chaplain Nancy Victor and Van Groot, Noor Mood, Rabbi Esther Adler. Most of you, I think, have met, but in case you haven't, that's who's with us tonight. And tonight we're going to talk about hope and how that fits into our traditions. And as we start that conversation, I guess I feel like I want to acknowledge what happened in Barcelona today, and there was an attack, a van that went into a crowd. 13 people at least have died, and it was an attack that does not reflect any of our religious traditions. It's an attack that comes from no faith, I think. And so it can be hard to maintain hope sometimes, and I think that it's important that we explore that. And I want to start with one story from a woman named Claudia Horowitz. And she's responding to the question, what does peace mean to you? But this, I think, relates to all these other topics. And she says, we need to be rigorous in our understanding of peace, and we need to be specific. We need to identify the kinds of peace we're talking about, and we need to be unflinching in our ability to articulate that and put it on the table. I feel like folks are talking about it less and less in these ways that I find really fascinating and alarming. I wonder if we've given up on the possibility of peace and we're settling for whatever else is possible. Occupation, low level of conflict, making ourselves comfortable with proportional response. Whatever the thing is in terms of the global arena, have we given in to the darker side of our nature in some unconscious way that we're not totally aware of? Have we been complicit, and do we really want to do that? So as we explore this idea tonight about hope from our traditions, I guess I'd like to keep that in mind as we think about what's going on in the world. The dedication in my book, I just actually recalled this today as I was getting ready. And I don't have my glasses on. For all who tend to the light of hope. And if you'll notice, the setting of that photo is right up here on the hill in Holden Village. So I think this is the perfect time. I think this is the perfect place. And I think we are the perfect people to have this conversation. So thanks for coming tonight. And I think tonight it's Nancy's turn to start.
Okay.
All right.
Do I still have my minute, or did I use it up?
No, you still got a bonus minute.
Okay.
You're good.
Good. All right.
Yeah. Hello, everybody. It's really hard to be in the midst of a beautiful place, an inspiring place, and reflecting on sorrow and worry and fear for the next few days. And I know, really glad to be a part of the conversations later, too, and tomorrow as well. So I finally got to take a little hike today. I did not go up to Copper Basin. I probably wouldn't have made it up to Copper Basin, but I did make it on the 10-mile hike out to the creek and the falls. And my intent on this journey was So David Hahn in his presentation Monday had, like in the book of Revelation, one of those books that I have come to really enjoy. I teach New Testament at Hamlin, and I thought as a like an experiment that I would walk and be reflecting on hope, and I would write a letter to each of the 9 churches. You know how in Revelation, God is writing a letter in a sense, or the prophet is envisioning a letter to each of the 7 churches. And I thought, what if, in my kind of imagination, in my prayer today, would I write a letter to each of the 9 cities? Is it now 10 cities? I don't.
I think 10 cities that are planning on having
the protests, this white supremacist protests. Yeah, and thinking like Terry over there is going to be in Seattle, standing, and we talked a bit about placing oneself in a non-peaceful protest, but that doesn't guarantee the people around you are going to be peaceful, and what kind of risk, and
nonviolent.
Yes, he's going to be part of nonviolent protests. But the people around could be very unpeaceful and could even be provoking. And Paula?
Pig and Chuck just told me at dinner that all the rallies have been canceled because they can't get enough people to sign up to go.
Whoa, that's hope. There it is. Wow. Okay. Well, it's still an issue, but maybe Terry's still going to go to Seattle and maybe stand with some people, right? All right. Well, I went for a walk going to contemplate these, what I would write as the letter to the 9 churches as a kind of maybe even midrash of my colleague here. And as I was walking along, so this is my first time, you know, really trying to be open to the landscape and to see these like huge curved trees whose bark is burned, many fallen over, but many standing. But what really caught my eye were all the purple little flowers all over the place. And like I could like, okay, this is a metaphor. Earth is sending me a letter. I better be reading it here, in terms of hope, that it we do need to be seeing the scary fires around us, the perhaps destruction, devastation, though I know that's part of the land here, but thinking about that in terms of our society. But there's also this small purple flowers that are coming back and saying it's not the end, it's a journey still. And and I thought that, like, for me, that's a kind of hope. And I don't want to be too romantic or naive. In fact, maybe we need to hope against certain kinds of hope that may not be helpful, but because of the risk, because of the demand upon our lives, that, you know, placing yourself out there. I've had conversation with Len today about a couple of things like this. Placing yourself out there means taking up a kind of risk and a potential that, and that led me to reflecting on the book of Romans. It's actually in Revelations as well, a very powerful symbols of the groaning of creation, the groaning of the spirit within for the revealing of the children of God. And I think, can we hear, part of the hope is hearing the groans, hearing our groans. Revelation uses these images of the birth pangs and the death throes. And they're not really pretty images, but they're part of a real hope. I would argue in the end, a hope that means that you may, kind of like Moses. Moses didn't get into the promised land. Each of us have our part to play in listening and responding. So hope. So how much time? Am I? Okay. Paula had some of my time. Okay. So when we talk about hope, theologically, for me, this talking about the doctrine of eschatology, big fancy word, eschatology, the study of last things or end things, it's called. And a theologian very important to me, Catherine Keller, up at Drew, says, well, eschaton, that word that we typically think of as end, can also mean edge. And that, like being on the edge, hope for me means being on the edge, kind of like being at the coast along the edge of the sea, that we may not know exactly the way before us, but this openness, I don't believe in predestination, but this sense of the divine journeying with the groaning, both the death, the birth pangs, being attuned to what is being born, recognizing what may be dying, and the fact that they've canceled, we might say, well, they're just going underground for some other time. Maybe. But I think that is something to celebrate, that risk, they're not protesting, and that may actually be a sign to us of the strength or the network of people who do not want that kind of, that's actually a strength, rather than seeing the emergence of white supremacy as somehow a meaning that we're not strong. So I want to finish with a very short little poem from Wendell Berry that evokes the sense of the flower. This is from A Small Porch that conveys some of my own hope. Love is the crisis of our work. When the watcher speaks of love, he is speaking not of history, not of past or future, but of the love in which all time has moved, in which all things were and are to be, the love that is before the beginning, that is beyond the end, that is entirely present as the flower of a day.
What does Islam say about hope?
Okay. First of all, I just would like to say I didn't hear the news about the Barcelona, but you know it's unfortunate. You know, and in a way, it's good to be away from social media and internet. You know, but in a way, you have no idea what is going on around the world. And it was good to hear that the 10 series are not planning to have this, but I always have hope that there will be better days ahead of us, no matter what. And when there's a challenge or difficulties, there will be ease after, comes afterwards. And there's a hadith that is Islamically, the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, says, and there's also the Quran, one of the verses in the Quran says, "Inna ma'al usri yusra," every difficulty, there will be ease that comes afterwards. So when I see a lot of challenges, whether it's Islamophobic or racism or, civil wars, or I see like country to country fighting each other or invasions, then I realize, it's a test. It's a test for the people. God is testing the people, if they can unite or if they can keep fighting and hating each other. And the best example of hope to me that I had since the day one when I came to the United States was a lot of people, they realized 2 weeks ago when the mosque I go got bombed, but to me, I knew a long time ago when some little incident happens, you will see a lot, the outcome is way greater than the damage. But colleagues, that we go together to the mosque, one of the guys was like, he was there when I got there that morning with the media, talking to the press, and I asked him, what is the plan after this? I was busy working with the police and the FBI that day, and then he said, I don't know. Maybe the guy is coming back tomorrow. You never know. And I was like, even if he doesn't come back, he may go to a different mosque. Yeah. But let's keep positive into our minds, And let's make sure the parents who send their kids Sundays, Saturdays, and Sundays feel comfortable and safe. Even if they take away from there, creates this mosque and take to the mosque. That mosque could be the next one. but let's, you know, be positive and have a good hope. And the guy was, okay, I could see his face was not taking what I was saying it, but I was just delivering to make sure, you know, he understands where I was coming from. What happened with it was like that one was Saturday morning. What happened Tuesday when all the churches and Twin Cities synagogues, people of all faces and non-faces gathered, and the mosque has a soccer field right behind the mosque, and it was full of 1,000 people. I asked him, now what do you think? And it's like, I never imagined that I would see this. And I was like, keep your faith always. There's always, when something happens, something better comes up after, you know. And he was like, that is true, but we are Muslim, we're still scared. And the fear always, as a human being, we have the fear, no matter what. But let not your fear overcome to your, you know, your hope or your like, success or anything. So, and then he said, man, you should be imam or something like that. I was like, nope. I am not going to be imam or sheikh. I'm not going to deliver a speech in the mosques, you know, about this. We have expertise, and I respect that. But, you know, to me personally, as a Noor, hope is something I always had since my childhood, from surviving from civil war, and I still have it. And when I heard this kind of sad news, personally, I don't feel big, like as much emotions as I see other people's in minority communities. I always says, this is my final destination. This is the land of opportunity. There's a good and there is a bad. It's just like the Titanic ship. It cares everyone, no matter what. You know? America holds everybody. Every race, every religion, every ethnicity, every socioeconomic classes. And there's always the bad, both from minorities and from the majorities. But if the minorities give us, you know, like the hope, if they give up the hope, then there will be nothing. And I don't want to, I would rather lose something else, but not the hope, personally. And that is who I am. So I know I have used 20 seconds, yeah. But I would rather pass it.
All right. I think Noor is donating you an additional 20 seconds if you want it.
You might use it later. All right, so under advisement.
All right, give me a zero.
You got a zero.
So I think Noor actually set me up well for what I am going to talk about, which he mentioned fear. And I found this panel of all our three panels the hardest one for me to respond to, so then I vaguely remembered, I think I once wrote a sermon about this, but I couldn't remember what I said, so I got on my computer and went back and found it. And I spoke about fear. And I think that, there was a self-help book a long time ago by a guy named Leo Buscaglia, Love is Letting Go of Fear. And I think that hope is letting go of fear, I would say. I think fear is part of the human condition. The very first words a human being speaks to God in the Old Testament, in the Hebrew Scriptures, is Adam. God asks Adam, where are you? Or why'd you hide? And Adam says, the first words he says, because I was afraid. So the first words the human being speaks is, I was afraid, or at least talking to God. And I was afraid becomes a theme throughout Genesis, actually. But that's very poignant that this is the first word human speaks. And fear is a theme, but I don't think God wants that fear to overtake us. I think fear is often what propels us forward, makes us run from the bear, right? Instead of letting the bear eat us. But we're not supposed to be overtaken by fear. When we're overtaken by fear, that's when, the bear eats us, or we end up in despair and lack of hope. So what about how do we get from fear to hope or from fear to faith? In the Torah, there's a Hebrew phrase, chazak ve'ematz, be strong and courageous, strong and of good courage. It's repeated 27 times. And we Jews like to count things, and so something that's repeated 27 times must be important. So Chazak, be strong and courageous, of good courage. So what is courage? Many different people from many different faiths and cultures have expressed the idea that courage is not the absence of fear, but the knowledge that something more important needs to be done. Or not the absence of fear, but the presence of fear and doing it anyway. Feel the fear and do it anyway. And so I think that for me as a Jew, I've said before, Judaism is more about the doing than about the doctrine, perhaps. So what can we do to conquer the fear, which will enable us to feel the hope? I think first thing is to name it. When we name things, they become known. And when they're known, they're less scary than the unknown, because the unknown is very scary. So once we name the fear, then what? So then I thought about a very important and powerful and scary prayer that's in our High Holy Day liturgy, that's on Rosh Hashanah, the New Year, and repeated again on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. Those are our most important holidays. Jews who don't go to synagogue any other time of the year will come on Yom Kippur. It's our Easter and Christmas. So, you know, you got, I don't know what you call them. I think you have something. We got twice a year Jews. That's Yom Kippur. So this prayer appears evening and morning on Rosh Hashanah, evening and morning on Yom Kippur. Or maybe it's just the days, I don't know. It goes like this. It's really scary. The Hebrews, Unatana tokef kedushat hayom kihu norava ayom. Let us proclaim the sacred power of this day. It is awesome and full of dread. The great shofar is sounded, the still small voice is heard. The angels, gripped by fear and trembling, declare in awe, this is the day of judgment. On Rosh Hashanah, the new year, it is written. On Yom Kippur, it is sealed. Who shall live and who shall die? And then it goes on. Who by fire and who by stoning? Who by strangling and who by this? And all these terrible ways to die. And it goes on and it gets really frightening. It's written on Yom Kippur and it's written on Rosh Hashanah and sealed on Yom Kippur. Who shall live and who shall die and how you're going to die? And that would be terrifying until you get to the very end of this long list of horrible deaths, where you get utshuva utfila utzdaka ma'avirin et roa hagzera, and, or but, you could read it either way, these three things avert a harsh decree. Three things. The Hebrew are tshuva, tfila, and tzedakah. What are they? Tshuva is usually translated as repentance, tfila as prayer, and tzedakah incorrectly as charity, but what they really mean to me, tshuva has to do with turning. How do we conquer fear? By turning. Who do we turn to? I think it's turning inwards, turning to our best selves, being honest with our fears, turning toward our fears instead of running away from them. We spend a lot of our lives running away. Turning toward the fear. Also turning in the traditional sense of repentance, making right any wrongs we've done over time can help us be healed from our fears. Apologizing, making things right, turning or repentance. Second one, tefillah, prayer. Prayer, I think, for me and for Jews, is a reminder of God's presence. It doesn't necessarily change things, but it reminds us of God's presence, however we might think of God. It's not, we can't let God take care of things. I think that's a difference between, well, that's something prayer doesn't do. There's a wonderful reading by Abraham Joshua Heschel, says, prayer invites God's presence to suffuse our spirits, God's will to prevail in our lives. But, he doesn't say but, I'm saying but, prayer may not bring water to parched fields, nor mend a broken bridge, nor rebuild a ruined city. But prayer can water an arid soul, mend a broken heart, rebuild a weakened will. And I think that's a wonderful idea of what prayer can do. Prayer can heal me so that I can go out and do something in the world. Another one that I love is pray as if, almost time, okay, one more thing. Pray as if everything depended on God. act as if everything depended on you. Which brings us to the third one, I think, that averts the harsh decree. Tzedakah means, comes from the word justice, but it's action. Take action. Whether it's in community, community also gives Jews hope, I think. In the business world, apparently, there's a saying, hope is not a plan. But we have to have hope, but then we have to get a plan. We have to do something, and that's where tzedakah comes in. It's a call to action to actually do something. And there's a principle in our tradition that it's not up to you to complete the task, but neither are you free to desist from it. So take action, take that first step, and that will help alleviate the fear, which will give hope.
Yeah. You just answered the question I was going to ask you, too. Thank you.
In my 5 minutes, how far over did I
go? Well, you were at 8.
No.
Yeah?
I'm sorry.
No, it was great. I would not have wanted to miss that last part for anything. Pray like everything depends on God.
Pray as if everything depends on God. Act as if everything depends on you.
Love it. I'm going to just ask a couple of one appreciative inquiry question of each, and then we're going to move back out to the audience. Nancy, does your faith call you to hope, or do you just choose to hope? No.
I'm an introvert. I have to think about things.
All right.
Okay. It's both. I'd say it's both.
I think it's both. So, I think why it is important to recognize it as both is because I may hope for something in a way that like sets forth a kind of conditional. I'm going to hope about this, and if it happens, then of course God is with me. But it's that. Being open, that to me is not, that's conditional, or laying conditions also on God and on history or others. And it's that kind of radical openness, call it a kind of existential openness, that I think God does call us to hope. But also hope's within. It's innate. It's probably neither or, because I also believe God is within as well as in all things. So,
thank you. And Noor, I'm curious if you would share with us when you were leaving Somalia and moving into Egypt, when you were living as a refugee, how is it that your faith sustained you during that difficult time?
That's a great question. So, we have always had a hope. Even when we face the toughest time in our life, when there's a civil war and you lose your own family members, sister and brothers, and the war is going on everywhere, and then there's a short-term hope and there's a long-term hope. Short-term hope was to make it tomorrow. So until the thing goes a little bit slow. The long-term hope was, will you be one day somewhere peaceful and go to school and have a better life? So, but the short-term hope was every night, tomorrow night, how are you going to survive? Where are you going to stay? Is the world going to expand this way or that way? Will you lose more members in your family? Or will you be all gone? So to answer your question about Egypt, that's when I started thinking about the long-term hope. Because the short-term hope, it was gone. Because I survived from the war. I'm in a peaceful country. But there was a lack of education, because unless you go, it's a long process, but as a refugee, you don't have a privilege to go and get from that country because your status is a refugee. And the third world countries, when you're living as a refugee and you're not from there, it's a long story to talk about it. But I had a hope that at least I have a peaceful place that I can go to sleep and we're all safe. But from there, what is going to look like your future? when you grow up, when you have a family, your own family, you have your own family, where, you know, those kind of hope. And to be honest with you, have my faith, Islam, you know, and God tells me a lot to always keep your hope, you know, for positive. And the one is who prays the most, always, you know, God is, you know, he's merciful, and, you know, and he's all loving, all caring, of course, but we were asking more, because we're human being, we ask more, but maybe give less, but, you know, but in reality, you know, we ask God a lot of things, forgiveness, for a better life. So to me, that's when I started having long-term hope to get a better life, like the one I have right now. But if you were asking me this question 12 years ago, before I came to the United States, I would never imagine I would live this life. I would be graduating MBA. I would be receiving MBA today, August, you know, 17, you know, I'll be done, or 18 today. I don't know. So that Thursday, today is my last class day. So I would never imagine this. I would have I would be married with a wife, you know, so there was a lot of things to live American better life. It was something beyond my imagination of hope. But now I feel like I can have better hope than what I have right now. Like, you know, I'm just like not outlining, but expecting to do more for community. When I say community, I don't mean my own law, like Somali community. I mean American community as a citizen of this world. People, when I use the word community, they feel like, okay, because I'm black or I'm immigrant. I don't mean that usually, you know. I mean as a global citizen, more global perspective.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for sharing. And Esther, what is it that you look worried? Sorry.
I had about my 8 minutes.
No, I loved what you said. What what gives you hope?
Me personally.
Yeah.
What gives me hope? That's a really hard one. And I don't really know the answer to it. My guess is experience. It's always turned out okay so far, and I have to believe it will again. When I was pregnant, it was a huge worry fest for me. I've had 5 pregnancies to produce 2 children, but while I was pregnant each time, and especially the ones that worked out, I always said to myself, look at all these people. All these people are here because their mom's pregnancy worked out okay. And that gave me hope that my pregnancy could be okay, because I would worry, worry, worry when I was pregnant. And I had to keep telling myself, most people got born. Most people get born, and most people are born okay, so chances are mine will too. So I think it's experience, mine or the experience of the world, that the bad stuff, this too shall pass, and the good stuff will happen. I don't know. I really don't know. One more thing. As I was trying to think of what to say in this forum, some of you already know I really like playing with language. And in Hebrew, the Hebrew letters that make the word hope, tikva, and the Hebrew letters that make the word repair, takana, are almost exactly the same. There's one little loop on the nun that changes the vav to a nun. So I think hope and repair are very, the act of repairing are very closely connected.
I like that. Thank you. We want to turn this to you, and if you would, just for a couple of minutes, turn to someone next to you, share with one another what gives you hope in your life. We're going to take a couple of minutes for that, and then we'll open up to questions. Second. All right, it sounds like some good conversations, but let's bring it back together. And I wonder if anybody cares to just share a couple of thoughts about what you were talking about. Anybody want to share what gives you hope? Yeah.
Sure.
My grandchildren give me hope.
Mm.
Three of the 4 are biracial. One is 21. Mm. 21, 8, 7, and 1.5. And they are all hopeful children. Their parents are very hopeful. They live at times, the parents, in fear. But they don't, their children don't know that. And I want to be hopeful for their future, for not just my grandchildren, for everyone's children and grandchildren. Because if we don't have hope, then there is no future. There is, it dies. So when I see these happy little faces and kids playing and wanting just to, I don't know how to say it, but if it weren't for them, I just told my husband, if it were not for our grandchildren, it would be difficult for me to have hope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's lovely. Thank you for sharing. Yes.
I'll tell the short version of the story, but basically on a commute home from work once, I came upon a strange scene. The vibe was real different, and come to see someone on the ground and people around me. And talking to people, I heard that someone had pushed someone in front of a bus.
Oh, God.
And these people were attending to the person on the ground. And there was a black woman, and there was a businessman in a suit, and there was a punker, and there were several people. And they didn't ask each other what their political persuasion was. They didn't ask what religion was. They didn't ask the victim. They all jumped in and helped. A couple people took off running after the person that pushed them into the bus. So if I focus on the person who pushed in front of the bus, I lose hope. But I choose to focus on all of those people who helped out, who were there for each other, who brought each other together. And I think it's the same in Barcelona. Several years ago, there were bombings on the train.
Yeah.
A lot of people were killed. The next day, a million people marched on the streets.
Yes.
And we'll probably see that also. Mm-hmm. That's where I tend to my hope. There's a million people, not in the country.
John.
Yeah, beautiful. Oh, okay. So share your name as you, if you want to share. We'll back up a little bit. What was your name?
Carol.
Carol.
Thank you.
My name's Tom.
Thank you, Tom. Yeah, thanks, Nance. Anybody else have something that you want to share? Nick. Oh, yeah, Nick. Sorry, I stole your thunder.
Go ahead.
I've noticed change, and I've noticed a lot of bad things happening. But if there was no change along with it, I would not have it.
Yeah.
We can't stay the same and continue to have bad things happening. We need to change somehow. One of those changes will be the right one.
Yeah, thank you. One more, and then let's open up to questions coming this direction. Anybody else?
I was just sharing that I didn't usually think of hope until my husband passed. And I didn't think that my world ended, and I didn't think that I could make it through. But I latched onto that word and had God's love and support from my church family and my family. And I'm here 7 years later. Being involved.
Yeah. These are all excellent. These are all beautiful. Thank you for sharing. Nancy would like to know your name.
Linda.
Thanks, Linda. Yeah, this is great. So this is our last night as a group up here. And so I think if I'm going to assume that it's okay if we open up to questions about hope in our traditions, but also anything else that's still residual out there. Is that fair? Yeah, and we'll see what we can, yeah, general comments or questions for the group. Yeah, we'll respond to you now. Yeah, way back here.
My name is Val.
Hi, Val.
Just a comment. Recently I read an article that said Christ said, fear not, 52 times.
Ooh. Yeah, that's a nice parallel. Yeah, Val, I'll just repeat that you recently read that Christ said, fear not, 52 times in the New Testament. And what was the number? You said, be strong and of good courage, 27 times that you have. Anybody want to make a comment on that up here at the front? Somebody else had their hand up. Oops, we'll move up there next. Go ahead. Go ahead, down on the bottom.
I'm sorry if this came up in previous sessions. I guess sometimes I think we forget some of the basics and take them for granted and assume we know. So I'm just curious to hear what your basic definition or understanding or feeling or whatever word you want to use to describe it is for God or for Allah or for Yahweh. I know it's such a basic question.
Oh, I think it's such a huge question.
But outside of Scripture, and we're somewhat familiar with scriptural definitions, but just what's, if you could give us a nutshell.
Who wants to do the nutshell first?
The compassionate heart of all things. The compassionate heart of all things. Kind of rooted in a mystical tradition, Christian mysticism.
Oh, he's volunteering you next, Esther.
We have faith in you.
So the long answer is that, and I said this in one of my sessions, Jews don't have a lot of doctrine on the big open questions. We have a lot of specifics on how we're to behave and act and live. That said, in the coffee break today, it came up the verse in Exodus where I think it's when Moses asks, who sent me? Who shall I tell them sent me? God, he asked to know God's name. And God answers, Ahiya Asher Ahiya, which interestingly enough, I understand in Christian tradition, or at least, I don't remember who was with us and said this. It was Jim. Said, that gets translated, I am that I am. And that surprised me because Ahiya Asher Ahiya is actually a future tense grammatically. I will be that which I will be. So for me, God is the great Ahiya, if you will. God is always becoming. I don't personally believe in God all-knowing and all-powerful. I believe in God growing along with us. There's a Jewish tradition that says God suffers along with us, so that when there's suffering in the world, we're causing God suffering, so that we have effect on God. And when there's goodness, we cause goodness to God. So maybe I would say God is becoming. I can't really narrow it down.
No, thank you. Noor?
I was just trying to get a chance to think about it, you know. So, in Islamic perspective, in Islam, God is, every chapter in the Quran starts with, in the name of God, the most merciful, the most beneficent. God in Islam, we call, he's the most compassionate, the most merciful, and the most, you know, forgiven. And in the Quran also he says in the verse, you know, I created the people to worship me. And the life we live right now today is a test for us. He's testing us to be, whether we do good deeds or bad deeds. And for me, like personally, if I speak on myself, you know, the prayer I was praying in front of the audience today, I was not praying just to show them, but it was part of my spiritual duties that I do every day. But I don't know if that prayer was accepted. I'm not sure. But I'm doing it to pass this to the test for this world, so I have a hope the life after can end up the heaven. And that's because he says in the Quran a lot of times, I'm forgiven. You know, I see God as the most compassionate and the most merciful.
All right, thank you, Noor. There were a couple hands up there. Yes.
I wanted to ask you guys about the importance of language to your respective faith traditions. It strikes me that in both language, both spoken and written, and word choice and different languages in terms of translation and oral tradition, there's a lot of depth there in each tradition. I'd love to hear just a little bit from each of you about that.
And your name?
Isaiah.
Thanks, Isaiah. Anybody want to take that first?
I can start right now. That was kind of easy, I think, you know, but that was a great question. And when I was, you know, saying the one of the verses from the Quran, it was in Arabic language. And Arabic language is not my first language. It is second. And English comes third. But my first language is Somali. So the Quran was referred to Prophet Muhammad in Arabic. even though that Arabic and the Quran is not exactly the Arabic that the people now, the Arab people speak. They understand, they can read it, but the terminology is kind of like, even it's kind of poetic, but it's not something that a human being can put it together. And but for me, you know, when I use the Quran in Arabic version, which is not even, you know, Arabic is not my first language, I feel it. There's some emotions coming with it. I'm able to say it in English and at the same time translate of in my mind in very first language, but it's better when I use that of its own language, Arabic, and then translate it either to Somali or English. But it's attached, it's something that's more spiritual when I use it, you know. So, I don't know, I cannot explain.
Is this kind of what, because we may answer it each differently, and because... Thank you, thank you. Well, this is just what's on mine. Maybe because I was so inspired to be a part of Esther's presentations with Midrash. So I teach New Testament, and I'm learning as much as students in the class. And it's just amazing how when you start to look, I don't see that there's one, I don't believe that there's like one meaning throughout the entire New Testament. And to me, that's actually exciting that there are multiple voices and to try to understand the dynamics of the voices. And one of the things I love when we see that, like John the Baptist, the Gospels record, or this sense, the Synoptic Gospels, that they have this sense that now is the day, now is the day. And then Jesus begins ministry. The day of the Lord is at hand. And this sense that there was the empire is dying, Roman Empire, the emergence of God's justice and mercy, God's reign, the restoration of people, like those are so now for Jesus. And then questions count. You can watch the questions rise as you go along. Well, oh my goodness, well, didn't happen. And one of the questions is, well, what happened then? The temple is destroyed in 70. On and on, this sense of a deferment of the reign of God and wrestling with, well, maybe we were wrong. Was Jesus wrong? Was John the Baptist wrong? Was Paul wrong? Paul did believe right now in my life, in his life, people's life, there was going to be a consummation of history and God's fulfillment of the promise and the reign. But it keeps this, so I find this really liberating in terms of the kind of interpretive challenge and responsibility of communities living with, from, in, questioning, continuing to be in dialogue and engagement, but yet how important our own discernment is in that prophetic word in our time. So I like the polyphonic character of the New Testament. I think that's a gift.
Incredibly important. I have to say more because I always have to say more. Language and words are just incredibly important in my tradition, and they're incredibly important to me personally. My mother was a wordsmith. She made me one. I'm sometimes, well.
You have a reputation in the Wesley Center.
Yeah, I was going to use a bad phrase, but a word cop, let's say. In the Hebrew Scriptures, creation comes about by the word of God. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God said, let there be this, that, and the other thing, and they came out of God's words. The Ten Commandments are not called the Ten Commandments. They're called the Ten Utterances, the Ten Dibrot, which is a word for word. And words are just so incredibly important. And my tradition likes to play with words in interpretation and midrash. There's a lot of word play. The Hebrew language is considered the holy tongue. Again, incredibly important.
Yeah.
And to me personally.
Thank you. And I think one more quick question. Was there one more hand up top? Yes. And your name, please.
My name is Sonia. I don't know how quick this is, but I'm struck that within our traditions, we all have our own interpretation, right, of how we live into that. And I guess I've been most struck listening to Nancy because that's my tradition. And I very much resonate with many of your interpretations of your theology. However, I'm struck with that perhaps, like, the white Christian America that Robbie Jones refers to in his book doesn't have the same interpretation of Christianity that you bring, if you were going to poll that white Christian America. So what I'm curious about, given that, actually, because I can't hear necessarily the same differences in the other traditions because I'm not as deeply embedded in it, how has being involved in this interfaith dialogue for each of you perhaps changed your own perspective, either moving your theology or your understanding, and how do you think that is important for each of us as we might engage this person?
Is any...
Who's reaching for the mic?
I'm there reaching for the mic, I guess.
Briefly for all of us. Sorry.
So I grew up being taught that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but through me. And that exclusivity, I think, contributes to this sense of white Christian supremacy. And some people try to redefine it, well, God's exclusively love, and love means this kind of thing. But I think I remember one day kind of sensing of, well, what was Jesus' way? And what was his truth? What was his life? And I'm certainly not going to convince 80% of white Christianity, you know? In one sense, I'm working in my garden where I am, figuratively, with my colleagues, with students who come along, who I'm blessed with, and that sense of trying to be faithful to the educative process there. But you're right, in some sense, I have more difference with my Methodist colleagues and my Southern Baptist colleagues than I do with some of my interfaith colleagues. And I don't know what the Spirit is doing something, I believe, in the world, something calling us into this horizon beyond this edge. And I'm on the way with that. And that I think it's giving up this notion of exclusivity and more strongly drawing on a doctrine of creation that has called me or invited me into the heart, compassionate heart of Christ, but also, or of Jesus. Again, that might be different, but of Jesus, I'll say. And that then redefines the prominence and actually more deeply roots me in the way of Jesus. So
you're volunteering, Esther again.
I would say working with Nancy and Noor have enriched my life incredibly. From both of them, I've learned about openness and bigness of heart. From Nancy, especially, sensitivity to the needs of the others, always listening for what the other might be hearing in what we say. And from Noor, I've learned a lot about Islam, especially this week. Thank you. But always. But more from Noor's self, how to be a person in this world and how to continue to have hope and to give. He says he doesn't want to be an imam or a sheikh. I hope he'll be president. I see him as mayor of Bloomington. Mayor of Bloomington. Noor. You have such, both of you, such a big heart. And John, too. And I've learned so much from all of you.
Thank you.
would you vote for me if I run for mayor? Because you live in Bloomington.
I will.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. So, and I just want to make sure, but, you know, the first thing, you know, as a Muslim, practicing Muslim, and not only Muslim, but also, you know, if I mention, I haven't mentioned the whole week what that denomination I believe in Islam. This is the first time I'm going to mention it, which is like, you know, I'm a Sunni. So, which is like 85% of Muslim population. But personally, it was my personal choice to become more open-minded, and it was through the help of not only the Catholic, you know, sisters or and the, you know, my friend I was talking about last night, who was not a Catholic, but was a different, but I don't know which denomination he believed that time. But also, you know, in working with, when I was in college, I was in Duluth, Minnesota, up north Minnesota, if you even know that. But there was a rabbi, David, and the community, that Jewish community lived there, that I got connected with them. And there was a professor, also one of my professors, she was a Jewish, and she introduced me to her family. And then she connected me to the her synagogue, to the her rabbi. So, and still I was in college. So coming back to, I started like connecting with the churches and the neighbors, my neighbors. And then coming to Hamlin, I had it was a great opportunity for me to know Esther and Nancy, who are totally two different faith backgrounds. I'm very open-minded, very helpful, ask any question I have all the time, and they give me a straight answer. So I feel comfortable in asking them anything I needed to know. And what I'm doing, and versus what the Islam says, I see myself, some people, they may see me, I'm Westernized, or I'm modern Muslim. You can call it so many different names that media or people use it, but I see myself as a Muslim practicing, period. And I'm doing what I see as right for me and for community.
Thank you. One little bit of housekeeping. I hope that you'll all be able to join us after Vespers. We'll take a short little break to stretch the legs, and then we'll be gathering for the community dialogue tonight about white supremacy and what's going on in the country. I want to thank all three of our guests up here for sharing their time and their wisdom, and for just being fun and hanging out. So thank you very much.